Hello, and welcome to Social Design Insights, the weekly podcast that brings you the leading voices of the social design movement from the fields of architecture, planning, engineering, and art. I'm your co-host, Eric Kessel, and I'm here, as always, with my co-host, Emiliano Gandolfi.
Hello to everybody, and welcome to the show.
And we're here for part two of our joint interview with Interborough and Ecosistema Urbana. Dan and Belinda are back with us for a second week to talk in a more refined way about their practice. If you haven't listened to the first episode, you can find it on our website. It's a really interesting narrative about the origins of these two practices and how they came out of sort of post-consumerist 1980s and 1990s, and really started to tackle this notion of public space, and it's quite fascinating. So have a listen to that. This week we're getting into a little bit more detail.
Last week's interview was really interesting, especially because these two practices have been so much engaged with public participation and self-organization of citizens, which is something that is emerging more and more in their generation and this generation of architects that emerged after the turn of the century. And that is somehow something that is not at all related to how participation was seen in the last decades, but it's more about finding a way in which to get, you know, citizens directly on the forefront, also in a very interactive and playful way.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was really cool. And as a classically trained architect, community participation just means a town hall meeting, right? And you get everybody together and you have this meeting. And I think what our listeners are going to find interesting about this interview is the diversity of tools that Dan and Belinda are speaking of in terms of digital tools and public participation and live feedback loops and all that stuff.
I think it's really exciting. And let's go directly to the second part of the interview, talking about urban action and engagement tools. I hope you'll enjoy the show.
Belinda, could you weigh in on this idea of engagement tools? As Emiliano and I were discussing this episode, one of the things that we liked about both your practices is a sort of creativity in how communities are engaged. And even for those of us in the public interest design sector, there's this lasting idea of community engagement being, you know, a town hall meeting or, you know, gathering around a space. I know that in addition to the example that Dan described with, you know, projections at City Hall and all this stuff, Ecosystema Urbana has been experimenting with a lot of digital tools for community engagement and soliciting community opinion. Could you walk our listeners through some of that and some of the more exciting things you're doing?
So we have developed this tool, which is called LocalIn, has been implemented in different cities around the world. And it's very intuitive, very simple, and it's an open source tool now that anyone can download and customize for their own purposes. And it's a mapping tool where people can geo-reference their ideas connected to certain topics that you define in advance. So it is interesting because by this very simple action, you actually get a mapping of how people feel around the different neighborhoods, what are the topics that are more relevant, or what are the kind of the most problematic areas or issues that people are, you know, kind of concerned about. It's simple, but at the same time, very powerful and very low cost already because it's already done and it's already open source, so anyone can use it. That's one of the things that we've been doing. And then another thing that I think it's important, another way of engaging people very visually and very experientially is through the urban action. So when I was mentioning before that part of the total budget should actually be incorporating this kind of participatory process beforehand, I think there are good examples of how before getting into the transformation of a public space, which requires a huge amount of money, can you actually test by mocking up some of the ideas so that you give the full experience to people. Ideas are no longer very abstract, they're very experiential, very real, and people can respond and react to them very, you know, easily. Because sometimes I find that, you know, it is difficult to get people to react to things that are just in paper or very abstract or very, you know, just drawings and so on. So you were saying that, of course, yes, town hall meetings are usually very boring or, you know, they're too serious or people just don't have the time for it. We usually try to create a dynamic that makes the workshop or the meeting fresh and fun. So we push people to be active. So it's not a lecture. It's not, you know, a place that we come in, just talk and leave and collect, you know, some votes. It's more like, okay, now we're going to play this role. We're going to do this. Now you have to act it. You have to perform it. And people get like, oh my God. We try to give them space for them to express themselves and to share their concerns. And I think they appreciate it because, you know, everybody wants to participate, but at the same time, they want to know how their participation is going to affect the final decision, which is very challenging because sometimes the political, you know, gets very, you know, complicated in between. So every time we do a participatory process, we want to guarantee that at least, you know, the message is sent, the message is impacting somehow some of the decision-making processes.
I think Interboro did a good contribution in this direction because in your work, The Arsenal of Inclusion-Exclusion, you're actually helping people visualize what kind of action, what kind of, you call them weapons, can be used by architects, by planners, by policymakers to in fact change their own environment. What do you think was, you know, the larger inspiration while you were doing this research, and what do you think is actually the impact?
I don't know what the impact's going to be. I hope it's huge. We'll see. It's coming out next month. When we do engagement and participation, I think the one other thing we haven't talked about is education, right? So, you know, now we're working in Cambridge, and it became clear that not everybody understands what a comprehensive plan is and what it can do for the city. And so, you know, we actually made a newspaper that tries to demystify the planning process. So there's a whole feature of asking people, like, what is a comprehensive plan and what could it do? And, you know, having different experts weigh in. But we try to do it through the built environment by looking at things that exist that you might take for granted and then linking them to a plan or a decision that somebody made. Right. And so we're working right now on something called Shaping Cambridge, which does that. You could be walking down the street and you see a dog park and you walk by it 100 times. And you don't know why it's there. You never thought about it. But now you'll have an opportunity to learn that, in fact, it's a product of this long discussion that the city had, a lot of different policies and planning that they did to ensure that people would be within a certain walking radius of a dog park. That is really at the heart of what this book is about, and this broader initiative called the Arsenal of Exclusion and Inclusion. It's trying to break down the built environment and say it didn't just fall from the sky. It's the product of decisions that people made. They could have been made differently. They could not have made these decisions. And in particular, this book is looking at the different policies and practices and, you know, physical artifacts and things that have been used to exclude and include in cities in the United States. So it's really a book that's supposed to give a glimpse into the everyday struggles of who gets to live, hang out, work, or play where and for how long. One of the hopes of the book is to help people kind of understand some of the different tools that shape the built environment, that create spaces, but that also create dynamics within those spaces. Why is there so much racial segregation in this country? And so that's one of the questions that this book tries to answer, for example. It's not exclusively about racial segregation, but it is one of the big things that we discuss in the book.
Could you give us an example of, you know, one of the weapons in the arsenal?
There's 156 weapons profiled in the book. There are some that are about housing, that is, who gets to live where and why, and what are the different tools or what we call weapons that enable people to live in this place but not that place. And then there are kind of public space weapons, right? There are ones that are about who gets to hang out where and why and for how long. So these are weapons about, you know, determining who gets to loiter and why, and what are the different tools that define who can hang out where. And there's kind of contemporary examples, and then there's historical examples, things that don't operate much more. But an example that might be a good place to start would be something called the exclusionary amenity. This was actually one of the first weapons in this book. An exclusionary amenity, it's a kind of interesting answer to the question, why do we have so much segregation in the United States after, you know, nearly 50 years after we passed a Fair Housing Act that explicitly forbids against segregation? And when you're selling a house or renting a house or giving someone a loan, that is, we have this policy and yet we have an amazing amount of segregation. So the exclusionary amenity is part of a suite of tools that kind of explain why we have this kind of segregation. And what it is it's something that's an amenity for some that serves to exclude others. And so a good example would be that we talk about in our book We talk about this guy, Tom Moynihan, who's the CEO of Domino's Pizza, for what it's worth. And he wanted to build a Catholic community where he just wanted to have, you know, a city only for Catholics. But you can't do that because you can't discriminate in that way and say, this place is only for Catholics. So what he did was he built a gigantic church in the middle of it. And, you know, he named all the streets after popes and saints and things. And there's a Catholic university in the development. And he would say, well, anybody could live here. It's sort of open to anyone. But in fact, if you want to live in the community, you have to pay money every month. It's required to a homeowners association who's just go to maintaining the amenities, which in this case is a church, right? A Catholic university. So it's like, why would you live in this community if you weren't a Catholic? So it's a sorting mechanism that doesn't violate the law of the Fair Housing Act, even though it violates its spirit. And so a lot of what we look at in the book is those kinds of weapons that try to explain why we still have so much segregation in spite of some pretty progressive legislation and some pretty clear legislation says we should not have this the kind of segregation that we do.
Dan, I want a copy of the book.
We all want a copy of the book.
I know. It's actually done. It literally should be going to the printer today.
So really, there's no excuses. I want it in a couple of...
But I mean, there's tons of other examples I could give. If that one doesn't work, just let me know. I'll be happy to tell you another one. 156 of them, after all.
Thank you, Dan. We should probably just record another conversation with all the anecdotes of the arsenal of exclusion and inclusion. Or maybe even think about an audiobook. We're taking a short break now, but we will be back soon with the conclusion of this exciting conversation between Belinda Tato, Dan Doka, and Eric and I. If you want to know more about our honorees, please check our website, currystonedesignprize.com.
Welcome back to Social Design Insights with your hosts, Eric Kessel and Emiliano Gandolfi. We've been speaking for a second week now with Daniel Doka of Innerborough and Belinda Tato of Ecosystem Urbana about how to reclaim public space. Dan, I wanted to take this idea of exclusionary amenities and the 156 weapons that we were talking about before the break and shift it towards the dynamic between the powerful and the powerless. And I think the story you told about the CEO of Domino's is a great example. We originally conceived of this episode and this question, I think largely because Emiliano and I have looked at how the neoliberal era, there's been this push to privatize public space. And whereas at one point public space was considered a shared amenity, now there's this enormous pressure to capitalize it, to privatize it, to get a return on it. What tools do designers have and what should be their stance? Because they are inevitably in this strange position of being in a market economy and having to work for someone that wants to build something. What's your advice to young designers who would like to stand in opposition to this recent trend, this recent attack on public space?
I do encourage a lot of my students to consider public sector careers. I'm very happy where I am. I think I made the right choice. I love what I do every day, and we find a lot of opportunities to do good in the world, I think. But I do want to say that for a lot of my students, I try to get them to think about the public sector. There was a time, you know, in the 60s, I think, when maybe later, where like the best and brightest went to the public sector. And I think now that's not the case. And I would like to think that maybe things are changing. And I try to get my students to go work for HUD, Housing and Urban Development. You're moving to New York City, think about a career with the Department of Transportation or city planning. So I'd like to think that we'll have more designers go into the public sector where you have an opportunity, more of an opportunity, I think, to not be beholden to profit. This sounds naive and it's obviously very general, but I think in the public sector, it's easier to do projects where your client is the public interest and what you do is help the public interest. That's not to say it's impossible as a private firm, and I think we've had some success in what we do, but to the extent that there's an audience here, I would like to encourage more good designers to sort of think about the public sector.
Belinda, you see, I mean, considering also Dan's response, of course, the European context is quite different, and you guys have been working mostly in Europe and South America. Would you actually see that there is a difference, or do you think that nowadays the differences in policies of public space and city management are becoming less and less?
There is difference. I must say that every time we work for a city, there was an inspired person within the city for us to be there. And every city that has been transformed for the good, and you know, this transformation relating to public space or to transportation or whatever, there is always a very powerful team or person leading from the public sector. As designers and, you know, private companies, and you know, we try to do our best, but in the end, it is decision makers who are in the city and in the public sector, the ones making the choice. So I really not only highlight your comment, Dan, but actually also support it, because our experience, it was always like that. Every time we got an opportunity to, you know, every time there was an interesting competition going on, it was because there was somebody in the administration who really thought there was a need for a change, for a transformation, for getting new ideas, for innovation, and so on. And I always say that no matter what we design, what we think of, there has to be always somebody on the other side committed to do the follow-up, to maintain it, to change the local regulations to make it happen. Because we, you know, we finish the work and we leave. I mean, that's how it works. But in order to bring any innovation, there is always some kind of behavior, some kind of regulation, some ways of operation that need to be reframed or redone, and that requires somebody committed on the other side. And then regarding your question, of course, there are differences. And, you know, we in Europe, we always take for granted that the meaning of public space is like that everywhere. And it's very interesting because, for instance, a couple of years ago, we were working in Honduras. And, you know, a friend of mine said in Tegucigalpa, he was saying, wow, there is no public space here. There is nothing public. There is nothing which is space. So it's a very different context. It's very challenging. And but also because we have this European experience, we can really, I think, inspire others to really prove that there is another way of living cities. I truly believe that public space can make an upgrade of the living standards. I really think that those cities that are the best are the ones who have a very good quality public space, because public space is the more democratic space, and that is what everybody can, you know, enjoy for free, right?
Again, agree with everything that Belinda said. I don't want to give the impression that people should not go into the private sector as well, or that that as designers in the private sector, we're powerless. We're not. As I mentioned, I think we've had some success in doing some good work, helping build better public spaces as a private office. And I think one of the things that we can do is ensure that we design open, accessible places that really work for everyone. That sounds really generic, right, and vague, but I do think that one of the best things we could do is design spaces that people really, really feel comfortable in and belong in and want to be in. And that doesn't always just mean creating an open space or designing a, you know, space that says welcome to everybody. Sometimes it means designing spaces that actually have amenities in them that are very attractive to different populations, right? And so a lot of the work that we try to do is to try to create spaces that are attractive to particular publics who we think might not otherwise go to a public space. And in that, it's very similar to the engagement work, right? Where we were saying, if you assume that not everybody's going to go to a public meeting at 6 o'clock, you have to think of other things. You have to think of other engagement tools, focus groups and models and tables and fun activities to get other people to participate. I think public space design is the same way. It can't be generic. And you really have to, I think, work hard to figure out what would make this group want to be in this space and what would make that group want to be in this space and so on and so forth. And you really have to design things in a specific way in order to create a welcoming, accessible space.
If we look at the future, what should be the strategies that we should adopt in order to make public space a catalyst for urban regeneration? What do you think will be the key features and the key strategies that will actually improve our livelihoods?
Inclusiveness. Probably the trend right now is actually the opposite in many different ways, because of the political scenarios that we're living all over. because of the economic scenarios that cities are really struggling to keep up with the maintenance costs of very good quality public spaces, and they're trying to find and develop new ways of creating new economies that are related to the public space, so it's not so public anymore. Because of climate change, it's like, you know, climatic comfort is still key to actually, you know, provide the conditions for people to get out and socialize and just use the space. For instance, we were doing a research in Bahrain, and of course the challenge of using public space is a new scenario to us, because even if we consider that the climate in Spain is difficult, it's nothing compared to it. So there are these different kind of tendencies that make us think that public space could be in danger somehow. But at the same time, I think we can agree that still those cities that are very attractive for many people is because of their vibrant public spaces, is because of their originality, their genuity, like, you know, and it's because there's still life beyond shopping malls and private space. So on the one hand, it's very basic. It's like if we keep on feeding these public spaces, making them very attractive, comfortable, inclusive, good quality, and find ways of maintaining them in time, which is also related to a community fact. So is that the most connected a community feels towards their public space, the more eager to be to maintain it and to claim for it. So I don't see a kind of a radically different scenario. I just think there is some kind of basics, which is still are, you know, challenging because of the current kind of trends that are opposite to it.
I think that's an interesting observation, and I think we might be witnessing another example of the American and European dichotomy. I think there's an intrinsic worth attached to public space, you know, in a European context. And as you were speaking, Belinda, I was thinking about the developing world context where, you know, some of these megacities have almost no public space. You know, you have a million residents in a neighborhood and not a single soccer field or anything like that. But Dan, let's go back to Miliana's question and turn it back to, you know, a U.S. context. Are we facing the same situation? Is our public space in need of defense?
It is. I mean, I think we've seen for a while and probably only going to get worse, kind of militarization of public space. Failing that, at least an attempt to design public space so that it's for someone at the expense of someone else. We've all seen the examples of the spikes in the bench to keep homeless people away, or the armrest on the bench, you know, to keep people from being able to lay down. And I think that stuff's pretty basic. But I think that here we see all kinds of devious ways, I think, that people try to control access to space out of fear. You know, in our book, we have all kinds of examples of, you know, a town demolishing basketball courts and replacing them with a hockey rink because they were afraid of African-Americans from a neighboring town coming to their park. So what do? They get rid of basketball and they put in a hockey rink, which they think will deter these invaders, as they think of these people from the neighboring town. We see curfews. We see, you know, bans on saggy pants. We see all kinds of these things. We see the use of music, right, to coming out of speakers in public spaces to scare skateboarders away, you know, play classical music and watch the skateboarders go away, because who wants a skateboard to Vivaldi or whatever, you know. And I think we just see so much of this stuff, and it's all out of fear. It's all a way to just try to keep people from being together in a space. And so the first thing I think we have to do is fight that. I mean, we have to be aware of it. We have to be hip to the kind of funny forms that these exclusionary tactics take. The beach is like another great place where, you know, we have a public trust doctrine in the States, and in most states in this country, you can't restrict people from going to the beach. We have a right to it. And yet you go to any beachfront town and you see, you know, all kinds of ways that people try to deter people from getting to the beach with, you know, really expensive beach tags or, you know, phony parking fire hydrants so that people can't park near the beach, or all these things. So I think that the first thing we have to do, again, is really just be super aware of and fight the impulse to close off these spaces and defend them. And as designers, again, as I said earlier, I think we really have to think of how we can do the opposite, use design to make the most amount of people mix in these public spaces and come together. I think that it's, you know, it's been said many times before me in many more intelligent ways, but I think democracy is just completely unthinkable without open public spaces where people can mix and come together and see and appreciate difference. And that's a big role for us going forward as designers.
I think that's a beautiful thought and a wonderful place to close, and inspirational, especially in these times where basic ideas of democracy seem to be under assault, both in the U.S. and Europe. Emiliano, are you good?
Yes, I am good, because I think, we touched so many topics. Of course, I would have loved to hear more about some of the projects you guys are doing, but that would have been an encyclopedia more than a podcast interview. So I think we'll keep that for drinking a coffee another time, and hopefully we'll find other ways in our website to share some of your projects and to get our listeners more interested. I really think that the work that you guys are doing is extremely brave, because working in public space has a lot of connotations that are mostly invisible in terms of the actual design. But it's a lot of the quality of public space is not only in terms of space, but is also constructed through relations, through possibilities of economic integration, through spaces of encounter of people from different cultures. So all of this is a work that at the actual final result has a complete impact, a very strong impact in the final result, but that is not necessarily in an object that you can see designed on a square or on a corner of two streets. So I think that endorsing design as also policies and thinking in at the larger dynamics, it's extremely brave choice, but it's a courageous choice that is absolutely necessary today to make a difference.
Now that's the last word.
Well, thanks for saying so.
Many thanks to you both. This has been a great interview, and I think a great way to start off this month's question about, you know, how design can recapture and protect public space, an increasingly urgent issue with all the turmoil going on. So our thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
This was really fun. Yeah.
You've been listening to Social Design Insights with Eric Kessel and Emiliano Gandolfi. We'd like to thank our guests in the last 2 weeks, Daniel Duoca of Innerborough and Belinda Tato of Ecosystem Urbana, both for their time and for their insights. Social Design Insights is an initiative of the Curry Stone Design Prize and the Curry Stone Foundation. For more information on each of these practices, please head to our website at currystonedesignprize.com. There you'll find galleries of their work, a narrative of their histories, and a few links to further your research. And if you haven't already, please find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram for all the latest news on social design.